welcome to Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, a young adult literature podcast, their film and television adaptations, and everything in between. I'm Joe.
And I'm Brenna.
And our show is located on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Anishinaabe on lands connected to the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 of 1805.
And on the Tecumloops Tay-Sequepin territory within the unceded traditional lands of Sequepin Ulu. And Joe, I did a lot of research for today's land acknowledgement, okay?
Ooh, so okay.
Just buckle up. Okay. So today's text, Wild Pork and Watercress by Barry Crump, is set primarily in Tay-Uruwea, the Rohe, or historical home, of Tuho. In acknowledging this territory, we acknowledge Tangata, Wenhu, and the importance of the Treaty of Waitangi. Joe, I have two interesting facts for you about this territory, okay?
Okay.
So one, Tay-Uruwea is a Maori phrase that means burnt penis.
Okay.
I had to get it in. There's no way, it has nothing to do with the book, but I had to tell you about it. So that...
It's not going to come up organically otherwise, right?
No, it's not. And then second, Tay-Uruwea has since 2014 held legal personhood. So it's the first natural resource in the world to be granted the same legal rights as a person.
Oh.
Yeah. So this big stretch of basically bush where the book takes place wasn't then, but is now. It has personhood.
Interesting.
Okay. I know, right? Yeah. So the film, Hunt for the Wilder People, conversely, was shot in the North Island Volcanic Plateau, where the Tangata Wenhu, which means people of the land, are the Ngāti Tuwhertoa, and the Waitakere Ranges, or Te Weo Nui a Tiriwa in Maori language, and this is the Rohe of the Iwi Te Wau Nui a Tiriwa.
Well done, Brenna. Here's the thing. Looking at it, it kind of breaks your brain because it feels like, oh gosh, how is my tongue going to work around these words? And I feel like that is one of the challenges that people typically have around Indigenous languages and specifically land acknowledgements. It's like, I want to go into this with the best of intentions, but then I'm just afraid I'm going to F it up.
Yeah, I do think people are afraid of screwing things up. And I'm a big believer that when we make an honest effort to do the right thing, we're not going to get, like, killed for it. Mm-hmm. That's what I truly believe. And I really hope I didn't horribly mangle any of those words. I did practice ahead of time.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the other big thing. And also, because we've been recording some of these episodes in advance, because, you know, life and all mm-hmm. the other stuff, I did want to give a quick shout out to a New Zealand listener, Beth, who did write in to note that we did pronounce Aotearoa. Oh my gosh, I'm terrible. But yes, Beth did write in to let us know that we had got it wrong on the first episode. And then I reassured her, yes, don't worry, we corrected it. And by we, I mean you, Brenna, corrected it in our Whale Rider episode. So yes. Keep those corrections coming, folks.
Yes, the Maori term for New Zealand is Aotearoa. And we did get that wrong in the Whale Rider episode for sure. And have fixed it in subsequent episodes. But yeah, it's all a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good times. It's part of the reason we wanted to do this.
And, you know, I often tell people that, like, one of the best things that this podcast has given me is greater comfort in screwing up in public, because our listeners are really mm-hmm. good about correcting us kindly. And yeah. I've always been grateful for that.
Yeah. Okay. So, Brenna, this is the final week of our New Zealand month, and we're doing an interesting text because, as I mentioned, I think in that first week, the genesis of this particular block of programming came from us wanting to talk about Taika Waititi, because mm-hmm. he's arguably one of the most prolific or well-known internationally Maori / New Zealand directors. So we always had plans to cover Hunt for the Wilder People, and then it kind of steamrolled and expanded out into a month of programming. But here we are. But before we get to his film adaptation, we do need to talk about Wild Pork and Watercress.
Yeah, so this book is by Barry Crump. It comes out in 1986. And Joe, I don't know if you did any Googling about Barry Crump in your prep for this episode, but this guy maybe brings new meaning to the word prolific. Like,
oh, okay.
Dozens
I just read the introduction, so I was like, okay, so we've got another white creative who's talking about a Maori perspective or writing from a Maori perspective. But yeah, it did seem like he had written a fair amount.
Yeah, like dozens of books and all kind of like New Zealand travelogues. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I didn't read any other books, but I get the sense that this is a very Barry Crump book.
Okay.
There's a lot of like, yeah, sort of lightly humorous reflections on what it means to live in New Zealand, a lot of sort of travels through the bush, a lot of representations of kind of people who live on the outskirts of society. So this really does sort of fit into the oeuvre as near as I could figure.
Okay.
And this one comes out in 1986, and it was very popular. And you can tell, like, I don't know if your book had the foreword by Taika Waititi in it, but you can tell there's, like, a huge amount of affection for Barry Crump in general and this book in particular.
Nice.
And definitely get that sense. So I'm interested, as we dig in today, to talk a little bit about what's different about the depiction of Maori by a white writer here than maybe in something like Flight of the Albatross? Because I do think it's a bit maybe more rounded, maybe is the way to put it. But maybe we should do a plot summary first.
Okay. Yeah, we'll start there.
Okay. So this is the story of Ricky. Ricky is a young Maori boy who has been kind of just in and out of the system his whole life. He's not had a stable growing up. He's been in and out of care homes and foster homes. He's done a whole bunch of kind of like minor crime. Mm-hmm. And he ends up being taken in by his maternal aunt, Aunt Bella, and her husband, Heck. And Hector is like not super stoked about taking in a kid. However, over time, as Ricky settles into life, so they live kind of on the outskirts of the bush on a kind of ramshackle farm. It's sort of functional, but not pristine. You know, there's many times when Ricky's like, why don't we fix this place up? And Heck's like, why? No. Why would I do that?
Yeah.
So they raise sheep, and they do a lot of, like, Auntie Bella has a garden. They produce, like, basically all of their own food. They don't even have electricity anymore. What? No, but it's important. This part is important because otherwise you would not believe anything else that happens if they weren't already living, like, a subsistence existence.
They're very resourceful as well.
Well, they have to because, like, Heck is stubborn and, like, he gets into a fight with the electric company and cuts down the, like, hydro poles to his house. So, like, they really do exist on the margins. Unfortunately, Auntie Bella dies and they have to make a decision about what to do with Ricky. And Ricky, like, does not want to go back into care.
No.
So, and Uncle Heck is going to lose the farm because everything's basically, like, in his wife's name, as near as I can figure. And he knows the family's going to take the farm. So he's like, well, I'm going to the bush.
Yeah. I mean, I even got the impression that they may not be married. So he may not even have a claim over the land because we're told that she has other siblings who just want to sell it off and make a profit and move on. But Heck doesn't want to give it up. Or rather, he realizes that he doesn't have a say in it, but he also doesn't want to go back into society. So yeah, he's happy to just take off and live in the bush. And of course, Ricky says, well, we're family, so I'm going to come with you. And despite Heck's protests, basically the two of them set off on an adventure.
They kind of outstubborn each other and Ricky gets his way. And the book is really just the adventure of them living for almost 2 years in bush. It is wild. They have, but it's again, like, it's not actually that different from how they lived at the farm in many ways, right? Like, they use what they find, they hunt. But over time, they go from being like, we're going to hide in the bush for a little while, to realizing that Uncle Heck is kind of like wanted by the police, because at a certain point it becomes kidnapping because
it's child abduction. Yeah,
it is. Because that's the other question. Like, they never spell this out, Joe, but like, much like you thought he and Bella weren't actually married, I got the sense that like Bella had custody of Ricky, but Heck never actually did. So like, there's all this kind of like legal ramifications. And then when they do at one point get stopped by park rangers, Heck holds a gun to them so that they can get away. So now he's wanted on firearms charges and like the whole thing just keeps expanding. And really, they just keep hiding.
They just keep moving.
Yeah. And they're better at it than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so they keep evading police. And it sounds like nothing is happening except that everything is happening. They're like getting attacked by boars and Heck breaks his foot and they have to like camp in one spot for 6 weeks. And
Ricky has to learn how to hunt because if not, they would starve to death.
And they meet this guy called Quiet Brian, who they could have stayed with forever, except that
they don't trust him.
They don't trust him, but also they're very aware that anybody who does help them is also breaking the law. So they try to not stay in any one place too long.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they give themselves up. I mean, really, they meet this guy named Robbie and he offers them this other plan to like, he would only be another 6 months until Ricky is out of foster care, basically. So why not just kind of suck it up and deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so they agree to do that. And they go back into the bush as soon as Ricky's free.
Mm-hmm.
And probably has a really sad ending because they never get heard from again. The end.
Yeah. There's a couple of points I think that are worth talking about because you're right. So much of the book is almost episodic adventures. I think it's really easy for maybe readers who don't fully understand what they're embarking on to look at this and say, it's just kind of sporadic things happening in the bush. Like, why does this book need to be so long or something like that? And a lot of it is really just Heck and Ricky learning to trust each other, realizing that they need each other, and then coming to a kind of begrudging love and familial connection. But yeah, you know, I want to talk about Aunt Bella because I think the rug pull of her death was emotional manipulation to the max, and I respect it, but I was it honestly took me probably 50 pages to recover from because I loved that character so much, and killing her is quite literally the point. It's meant to be devastating because we need to feel it as much as Heck and Ricky do, but I was not happy. I really miss that character.
Well, and you're absolutely right. Like, it's an unmooring of them all. Like, they would not make this ridiculous decision to go and just live in the bush with almost no supplies.
No, she would never have allowed it.
No, if she was still alive. And so there is a sense of, you know, on the one hand, this is the first family member who's ever taken an interest in Ricky's life. And so she's so important to him for that perspective. She's also like,
she's perfect.
She is perfect. She's so a saint. Kind.
Which is why she's gotta go.
Holy team Bella over here, Joe.
Loved her. Loved her. I loved this character. And then I loved her in the film, too. And knowing what was about to come, I was just like, oh.
Yeah. See, I watched the movie first this time.
Oh.
Which meant that I was waiting for her to die from the minute I opened the book, unfortunately.
I mean, to be clear, it does happen fairly early in both texts, but I would argue you get more Bella in the movie. So in the book, it feels very abrupt, whereas in the film, we almost settle in and then she dies and you think, oh, okay. And then the movie just continues. But yeah, I mean, maybe let's jump back to the end because I do feel that there's something highly confronting about particularly the book. The ending of the book makes them almost mythical, where they disappear into the bush and they're just never seen again. And you think, okay, we know enough from having read this that they are probably doing fine, but also it's not at all the ending I was expecting.
Well, the epilogue, so the epilogue is actually written by this Robbie guy, this third party who they met and who tries really hard to help them. He like finds them a lawyer when they do decide to give themselves up. He's really rooting for them. And so, and he's totally on their side. And he's like, yeah, they're probably dead. So you're like,
dark.
Okay. I expected Robbie to be like, and I'm sure they're still out there.
And he's living like, living it up, being fine. No,
and he's like,
dead.
Yep, they're absolutely still in the bush as skeletons. And I was like, oh, Robbie.
Okay. So they did survive for 2 years. You really don't have any faith in them? Okay.
And part of it has to do with the fact that they've gone back into the bush to get these photographs of a bird that they saw when they were on their travels. And the bird is extinct or is assumed to be extinct. And so the idea is that they're going to be the ones who discover that it's not, and these photographs will be worth a lot of money. And Robbie's like, everybody I've talked to has been like, if they're going to scale that part they're talking about, they're dead now. And it's like, oh,
Except we know that they've already done it because that's how they found the birds in the first place. Like, if nothing else, the book presupposes that if anyone can make a go of this place, it is these two of them. These two unlikely members of a found family can make it out and succeed. Like, I felt like the book was surprisingly heartwarming in that regard because in some ways it's a very conventional narrative of these two outsiders who come together to form a family unit. And yet it's not trite. Like, it doesn't feel schmaltzy in the way that I was afraid it was going to, because you know right from the outset that the two of them are going to come to love each other. And even when it happens, it still feels gratifying. It doesn't feel like, oh, you're being handed, you know, a children's dessert.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, I mean, we'll talk about this more when we get to the film, but the two changes that are made in maybe every adaptation we've ever looked at, Joe, is we get less backstory in the film version and we get a happier ending, right? Like, 9 times out of 10, those two things are true. And those two things are true here.
Big time.
And in the book, like, because we spend so much more time at the farm in the beginning, which you're right, somehow a lot less Bella in the beginning of the book, and yet a lot more time in the farm. And that's because Crump spends a lot of time building up the idea that actually Ricky can be competent when people trust him, right? So he's becoming really good at the various farm duties. He's turning his hand to everything, and Heck is sort of teaching him in his very gruff way. And so it's a foreshadowing to the fact that they will be okay in the bush because Ricky can learn and Heck can teach, even though they are kind of don't really like each other.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. It's really emotionally satisfying when they finally hug, which is like 30 pages from the end of the book. They finally embrace and you're like, oh, yeah, I needed this, actually. This was therapy.
That's so true. I'm curious. So you mentioned that Ricky is sort of falling into this archetype of the troubled youth. Nobody seems to really like him. He's bouncing from foster home to foster home. And now we've covered several texts that document the difficulty that particularly Maori teenage boys have either acclimatizing into white society or, you know, how can we redeem them so that they can be productive and recognized as contributing members? And I'm curious, you know, how does the depiction of someone like Ricky differ from Flight of the Albatross's Mako?
Yeah, this did not bug me the way Mako's depiction bugged me. And I would love to hear from listeners, particularly if we have any Maori listeners who have thoughts. I'm curious. Crump seems to be able to write from the perspective of this character. I think part of it is that Flight of the Albatross is very interested in Maori spirituality as being something sort of magical and other than what the protagonist knows, right? And so in many ways, it just exists as like a, I'm here to show you that there's another way of being in the world.
Right.
Whereas in Wild Pork and Watercress, we only have this perspective, right? So it's not being contrasted against whiteness all the time, although Ricky is very aware of how he is viewed by white people, particularly like the ways in which his body takes up space. Over the course of the narrative, he loses weight, right? Because they've been in the bush for 2 years. He starts the text fat and he ends it thin. And he's ecstatic because his point is that people will make space for a Maori kid who's thin in a way that they won't make space for a Maori kid that's fat. And one of the things he says is like, oh, it's almost like people see my skin as less dark now that I'm thin, which I found fascinating as a perspective.
There is a lot to unpack with this, because I was definitely picking up all of the almost internalized fat phobia that Ricky has, but it does feel like it's being filtered through a lens, right? Like, it's how people have reacted to Ricky, and therefore he has internalized it upon himself and his own self-worth. But I still was just like, no, Ricky, you can be fat and still be worthy of love.
It's very interesting, right? Because Heck obviously has been with him for 2 years, and at the beginning, like, teases him about his weight all the time, especially in the early farm scenes and the early scenes in the bush when it's like, oh, like, Ricky, can you even keep up with me? Blah, blah, blah. Like, really mm-hmm. stereotypical kind of BS stuff.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point in the narrative, and we don't notice it, he never makes fun of his weight anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
it just stops.
Yeah. And when Ricky has access to a mirror for the first time in like months and months and months and months, he's like, oh my God, I'm thin. And his total perception of his body and his like being in the world shifts. And it's so interesting because mm-hmm. I didn't find it like I have in some of the other books we've looked at. I guess I didn't find it offensive. I found it really honest, the ways in which Ricky has like absorbed, as you say, internalized fat phobia. Like he's absorbed the way the world looks at him mm-hmm. and he can't change his skin color, but now his body has changed and he's being very honest and recognizing that like people will treat him differently now, and they do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the other reasons that this works is because even when Heck is making fun of Ricky for his weight, he never makes fun of him, or he never makes racist disparaging remarks about him being Maori. And in part, that's because Bella is half Maori, or was mm-hmm. half Maori. You know, Heck clearly doesn't have an issue with different types of people. He would just rather be left alone. Like, Heck yeah. isn't a racist. He's not a misogynist or anything.
No, he's a misanthrope.
he's just a grump. That's the big thing. Heck wants to be left alone to do his own thing, and he doesn't like it when people interfere. And I guess I found that really fascinating because we only have Ricky's self-perception mm-hmm. that is driving him. Like, that's really the most Maori that the book gets. Because I was worried going into this that we've got another white writer trying to represent someone else's culture. And in some ways, Crump gets away with it because Ricky doesn't really care about the Maori part of himself. It hasn't been an issue in particular ways. And mm-hmm. as a result, we don't have to read about particular issues until really like that sort of like one area where, oh, that's why he gets bounced around from foster homes, because he's considered a juvenile delinquent. And then at the end, when he realizes, oh, now that I'm thin, maybe I can sort of blend in a little bit more.
Yeah, he's definitely aware of how people outside view him, but he's also really comfortable with Heck. Even when they're not mm-hmm. close, he's comfortable with him. And like,
right.
one of the things that comes out over the course of the narrative is that Heck is as good as he is in the bush because he has been trained by various people who he's, right. you know, camped with. And one of those people is an Indigenous woman. But the way he describes it is like, he, on the one hand, is using like outdated language for sure. Although in mm-hmm. 1986, I'm not sure if it was, but it certainly reads that way to us now. And there are a lot of things in the book that feel like very 1986.
Yeah. To the point where the book almost feels like it's not even set in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, is this set in the 60s? Is it set in the 50s? I couldn't be sure at points.
Yeah, that's true. But there is an inherent respect that Heck has for anybody who is competent, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's what he looks for in a companion, competency. And yes. so he's very open to giving credit to the people who have taught him the things they have taught him. Like, there's nothing about the fact that this woman was an Australian Aboriginal woman that means he can't like give her the credit she deserves. And that's mm-hmm. really eye-opening for Ricky as well, because
right.
it teaches him a lot about Heck, but also a lot about like what the world could be like if mm-hmm. people didn't judge him on the first appearance that he's, you know, this troubled Maori kid.
Right. Yeah. Which is so deeply ironic because we're told time and time again in the first act of the book that he would never fit in. And so he was just constantly on the lookout for, okay, well, when I need to escape, when I need to run away, how am I going to do so? And obviously, Bella breaks down his barriers and shows him what love looks like. But over the course of the book, when it's just him and Heck, yeah, you get the sense that Ricky finally realizes, oh, okay, if I'm actually just competent
mm-hmm.
and people give me a freaking chance, mm-hmm. then I can fit in and I don't need to think about running away all the time, which is why he and Heck end up staying together for as long as they do.
Yeah, maybe forever, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised by how much I enjoyed this book, Joe. I was did not know what to think about it going in, especially after Flight of the Albatross, which had lots of good qualities, but also had this very sort of exoticization, I guess, of the Maori characters that made me uncomfortable. There's none of that here. And I think for that reason, it feels really refreshing, particularly for its historical moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, right? In some ways, this is a slice of life, almost episodic survivalist book. And it just happens to feature a Maori main character.
Probably not a great book for vegans. Animals don't do well in this book.
No.
In general.
Well, it's hard to survive in the wild if you're not going to eat a pig or two.
It's true.
Why don't we transition over to the film?
Yeah.
Ricky Baker.
He is a baddie. A youth court regular.
We're hoping that this change of scene will help straighten him out.
You hungry? That's a silly question, isn't it? Look at you.
Ricky Baker, now you are 13 years old. You are a teenager and you're as good as gold.
Ricky, this is Heck. You can call him uncle if you like.
No, I can't.
Bella told me to tell you that you should give me something to do. Is there anything you want me to do?
Yeah. Leave me alone.
Cool. You ever been up in that jungle before?
There's about a million hectares of it, buddy. It's easy to get lost.
You lost? I'm amazed how lost you got.
You little bastard!
We got no choice but to camp out here for a few weeks.
Where are you, Ricky Baker?
More on this massive national manhunt.
Faulkner is Caucasian. Well, they got that wrong because you're obviously white.
You're going to jail, you pervert.
What'd you call me?
The pervert.
Back up, homies, and let go of my uncle! So what do we do now?
We run. No, we don't need to run.
Huh? Oh, yeah, this is fast walk.
Okay, so in 2016 comes Hunt for the Wilder People. It is written and directed by Taika Waititi. It stars Julian Dennison as Ricky, the incomparable Sam Neill as Heck, Rima T. Wiata as Bella, Rachel House as Agent Paula Hall, who becomes a very jokey adversary. So this is the Child Protection Services individual who is chasing after Ricky and really drives a lot of the conflict in the film. We also have Tiarora Nagati Melbourne as Kahu. This is a young girl who ends up befriending Ricky. And then finally we have Rhys Darby as Psycho Sam, who kind of takes the role of
Quiet Brian. It's sort of a Quiet Brian replacement.
Exactly. Yeah. But this is a far more sensational, over the top conspiracy theory version.
Yeah, definitely. In general, the film takes a lot of the same beats as the book and just like blows them up. So we have a lot higher stakes, less background, as I said, a happier ending, and just higher stakes in each of the individual incidents throughout, and a police chase that does not happen in the book.
I was going to say, to me, this was tantamount to what we've talked about repeatedly in dystopian YA film adaptations, right? Where we really amp up the action. And I feel like when you know Taika Waititi's style, this movie feels like a stepping stone towards something like his Marvel Productions, his bigger budget ventures. So we should note that the movie does have a budget of $2.5 million US. So it was quite expensive for a New Zealand project. I think about half of the budget does come from the New Zealand Film Commission. So it's the equivalent of how Canada invests in our feature products, right? Like the government will give you a large sum of cash, but it paid off handsomely. I don't know if it still is, but at the time when it came out, it was the highest grossing New Zealand film of all time. So it made $23.5 million total.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's really good fun.
It's a lot of fun, but I will say when we get to that last act and we go into high octane action adventure chase with like tanks in the army training ground, it did lose me because it felt like we had shifted the story into blockbuster territory and we had lost some of the, I guess, enjoyable intimacy that I had really appreciated in Crump's novel.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think this was an example of one where it was really good to watch the film first because I just enjoyed it, like, full stop. And then when I read the book, I was like, oh my God, this is so much richer.
So different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book is a satisfying character study that just mm-hmm. happens to have that survivalist bend. And the film is a full-blown, it's almost an action buddy comedy.
You know what it reminds me of vibe-wise is Hot Fuzz and those kinds of movies, right? Yes. Where we have a very ridiculous scenario played out to the absolute max.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
mm-hmm.
always like kind of small people who end up in a ridiculous place.
Yes. In over their heads.
Totally. Yeah.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about some of these performances? Because I have seen Julian Dennison. He's actually a supporting character in the second Deadpool movie. So I was aware of him as an actor. He's only been in a handful of films, but in terms of a quote-unquote unknown lead, I think he had only had a supporting role before this film, but he had worked with Waititi on a television commercial. So they knew each other, and he seemed perfect for the role, I've gathered. I think he's amazing in this movie.
He's extremely charming. He's mm-hmm. highly magnetic. So in the film version, the idea of Ricky as this sort of juvenile delinquent is like kind of played up to the extreme. So we see mm-hmm. him. We have this great montage of all the petty crimes that he's committed.
It's so funny.
when he does arrive on Bella's doorstep, he escapes like 3 times. He's much more of a handful in the mm-hmm. film than he is in the book. And Julian Dennison really sells it. He has that exact right blend of like, you know, if you had to deal with this kid in real life, you'd probably kill him. But also he's so funny and charming to watch on the screen.
Yes. He's a scamp, right?
Yes,
you know, where you
perfect.
Just think, I would throttle this child in real life. But on the screen, it's delightful.
Yes, absolutely.
And then, of course, Sam Neill. I didn't realize this is who the actor was. Like, I knew it was Gruff Old Man and Maori Child. Like, I'd seen the cover art, but I didn't realize it was Sam Neill until I looked closer. And this also just feels like perfect casting.
Yeah. No, he's absolutely letter perfect in this role. You believe that he could just disappear into the bush and never emerge again. Mm-hmm. And he sells the misanthropy like perfectly. It's a great kind of straight man comedy guy, like buddy pairing, because mm-hmm. Ricky is always able to play off of him. It's the casting is perfect.
It's funny because upon reflection, Sam Neill has already given this performance, albeit in a slightly less gruff way, but this is a variation of what he did in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, it is. You're right. You're not wrong.
So I do want to talk a little bit about Agent Paula Hall, because Brian, my husband, watched this with me, and he was actually kind of perturbed by this character over the course of the film, because, you know, we're very much mocking family services, because this woman is so adamant that she is there to protect Ricky, to the point where she is driving a tank alongside their vehicle in the final chase. And she's still, you know, saying, I'm here to protect you. You need to come with me. And Brian was unhappy with this depiction because he feared that it was making fun of the only other Maori character.
So I think this casting choice is really interesting because the book is maybe more explicitly condemnatory about mm-hmm. like the colonial child welfare system, et cetera, than the film is, particularly because of Rachel House's casting in this role, right?
Mm-hmm. We can get away with more because we're saying, okay, well, here's this character.
Yeah. And it's almost like in the book, it's very much like Ricky is avoiding, you know, Paheka society, right? Like he's mm-hmm. avoiding these white people who don't understand him and they don't understand like what he needs. And there's this sense of sort of the child welfare system as fundamentally misunderstanding like what mm-hmm. this child needs.
Right.
And that message is in the film as well, but it's not that he's misunderstood because he's Maori, right? Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. the police officers are represented also through these Maori characters. And I'm not sure what to make of it. I think it softens the critique, certainly, and I
yes.
totally get what Brian's saying. I'm fascinated by it considering we know that this is a Maori filmmaker, right? Yes. So like, what is the intention here? Like, I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, because in some ways, I almost looked at it like, I definitely took what Brian was saying because this character is a farce, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's veering into caricature by the end of the film, and obviously very deliberately so. And it made me wonder if it was the dangers of being indoctrinated into Paheka society, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you lose who you fundamentally are, if you're no longer connected to community and the land, you risk becoming part of a system that can ultimately hurt members of your own community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that's almost too strong because the film really doesn't do that. Like, this character is just silly.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. I think that might have been maybe intended on some level, but I'm not sure it works in the final draft. It's interesting to note, like, apparently Waititi started writing his adaptation of this book in 2005, right?
Yes, very early.
There's a lot of different drafts, and I've read that, like, very early drafts stayed very true to the book, and sort of the closer they got to filming, the more it started to veer away. And this is clearly Taika Waititi's sensibility. Like, the sense of humor here maps much more closely onto something like what we do in The Shadows than it does to Wild Pork and Watercress. And so I suspect that we're also tracking a decade where Waititi is finding his own voice and figuring out the ways in which he wants to use this text to tell a Waititi kind of story, which is really what we have here.
Yeah, I also read that, and I thought that was fascinating because there could have been just a completely different version of this, and I almost worry we would have gotten a downer ending that might have suggested that they do perish in the woods. Whereas, of course, in the film, it's like, we're going backpacking. Like, there's no threat that they're going to perish when they venture back into the wilds.
Yeah, and in the film, there's this sense. So there's an entirely other kind of creation that replaces Robbie here, which is like a Maori family who they first go to for help. So there's this hiker in the bush who is in a diabetic coma who they find. And in both texts, they go and they find someone to help. Mm-hmm. And in the film, they go and they find this Maori family who help them. There's an allusion at the end that that's kind of the adoptive home that
Ricky's
going to go into while Hex serves his time and stuff. So much more of a kind of satisfying, like, circular ending there, which also puts Ricky back in community with a Maori family, which
is
not something that happens in the book, obviously.
No, that to me felt like a very specific, like, Taika Waititi thinking about, okay, what would be the best possible outcome is that, you know, in both instances, Ricky ends up with Maori foster families. And to me, it seems very deliberate. Like, we're not at any point suggesting that an entirely white family would be an appropriate match for him.
No, exactly. Whereas in the book, he's just fully institutionalized, right? He goes into a care home. So it's a very different, thing. And there's always this sense that he might escape from the care home in the book, right? Like, Heck has to say to him, like, we have so little time left here. You've just got to stick it out and then you will actually be free.
Yes.
And so the ending of the film is a much more cinematically satisfying ending, right? Like, we definitely get the sense that everything works out for everybody, which is interesting because the stakes are much higher in the film. They think that Heck is molesting Ricky in the film, which is never, like, even breathed about in the book, right?
Yeah, but it's always played for laughter, admittedly, which I think is also wildly hysterical. Like, this to me is the absurdest humor of Taika Waititi. I can't think of too many other creatives who would have been able to pull this off without it seeming very gauche or just totally inappropriate.
There's a scene where Ricky is angry. So Heck basically calls off their police chase. He says, we can't keep doing this. We're not going to succeed. There are tanks and, like, the full-on army, by the way. So it's, like, extreme. And Heck's like, we're never going to get away with this. We're going to give ourselves up. And Ricky is mad at him and yells to the police that this man has been molesterating him.
The inappropriate wording. And then he shoots him in the butt.
And yeah, there's not many other filmmakers who could get away with this scene. I don't think there's not many two other leads who could get away with this scene. Mm-hmm. And even when they are reunited at the end of the film and Ricky says, I'm sorry for telling everyone you molesterated me. And he like uses the language. And it's just, it's this callback because one of the recurring things in both book and film is that Heck actually can't read.
Right.
Ricky's the one who has to do all the reading for them. And he makes fun of Heck for, Heck comes up with the word majestical to describe a place that they are in the film. And so there's this like constant callback for like language use and misuse. So the fact that that's Ricky's little signature is very funny and very absurdist, but also like stakes much, much higher once that comes out, right?
Yeah. You know, I do wish that I had watched the film first because I think I would have been able to appreciate it as opposed to just looking at how much we had amped up the stakes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the fact that this movie, it received rapturous reviews. I think it's 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, obviously commercially successful, does not surprise me at all. Like, this is such a charming, feel-good movie. And I love that it is slyly, almost subconsciously feeding people this Maori indoctrination that Taika Waititi has fed into this narrative. I kind of love that in some ways it's doing the same thing as Whale Rider, but doing it in a completely different mode. So that was a very, you know, almost austere, prestigious approach of like, hey, you should all appreciate this. You should be more educated. And Taika Waititi goes the other route and says, I'm going to entertain you almost to sheer absurdity, but also I'm giving you the same kind of messages.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't criticize that reading, Joe, because I agree with it completely. I'm really glad I watched it first because I think I would have spent the whole time being irritated by the lack of relationship development in the film because it's really not there. And the broadness of some of the characters, Waititi's much more interested in a laugh than he is in developing this sort of emergent relationship that we get in the book.
Mm-hmm. It still works. Like, it still plays in the film. It just, it also feels like the narrative of the film takes place over a couple of weeks, whereas in the book, you feel the time passing. And as a result, you appreciate the depth and the emotional nuance of the relationship.
Interestingly, I find it actually very hard to figure out what the time scale is in the film.
Oh, it feels sprawling though, right? Like, it doesn't feel short, but it also, you know, if you said months or years or a decade, all would be acceptable.
Yeah, there's a scene at the beginning where we're being told that Ricky is running away frequently, but we only actually see him run away once. And so there's always this kind of sense of like, I'm not really sure how much time is passing, and I'm not really sure how trustworthy any of these narrators are about how much time is passing. And the film plays with that a lot in a way that is actually really fun for a Trapped in the Bush movie, because I'm sure they don't actually know how much time is passing day to day.
No, and I'm really glad you said that, because we've talked a lot about the humor, and I think that's a lot to the script, but we need to note that Waititi is a really compelling visualist. So those scenes that you're talking about where Ricky does get lost in the bush, we see multiple versions of him. So like, we'll see one walking and then he'll disappear behind a tree, and then another version of him will come in closer to frame. And it really gives you this almost hallucinatory elliptical sense of how much time has passed? Where are we? I have no idea. Like, it's such a fun way of just denoting this.
Yeah, it really works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fun movie. I liked it a lot. I was surprised how much I liked the book, though.
Yeah, I really like them both, and I think they should be appreciated as totally separate texts.
Yeah, that's probably better.
It is an adaptation, for sure it is, but it's not a close adaptation. And, you know, we've talked about this on the show before about, like, one of the things when you're trying to judge an adaptation is figuring out if the adaptation has the same goals as the original text. And that is not the case here. No, these are doing two very different things.
Yeah. Very similar storylines executed in completely different ways.
I want to do a shout out for Rhys Darby. I love his little moment in this film as Psycho Sam. He's classic Rhys Darby in this role. Mm-hmm. If you've enjoyed him in, well, he's in a lot of Taika Waititi projects. He's also, of course, probably most famous for Flight of the Conchords. Mm-hmm. You'll enjoy it when he appears in this film.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, shall we try some YA bingo?
Yeah, let's do it.
Bingo!
Not a good bingo.
I'm curious to see how this is going to go.
Yeah, me too. So obviously there's a fair amount of abuse that has happened in Ricky's backstory. Not so much once they hit the road together. No, but
there's very little molestering that's going on.
Yeah. God, it's when he looks him dead in the eyes and then yells to the cops, he's molestering me. I lost it completely.
It's so funny, especially because the word just doesn't work.
Molestering. Sorry. I really want to give it to musicality for the score of the film. It's a fantastic score. It's entirely been written by like an indie rock band from New Zealand.
Nice.
But in particular, there's some original songs like that are sort of aligning with what's going on in the plot that are also great. It's a very good soundtrack.
Okay.
I'm going to give... Oh, montage, because the Ricky escaping montage is one of the best. There's also montages throughout the film of just like time passing in the bush, which is one of the reasons why time feels so fluid in the film. Right. So oftentimes montage feels like excessive or extraneous. Here, it's perfect. It's exactly what you want to see.
It's how montage is meant to be used.
Why does everybody else do it so stupid then?
Because they lean on it as a narrative crutch.
Yeah, it's perfect here because, you know, as I said before, like one of the things is they literally are trapped in the bush and you can imagine that time feels very slippery to them. And that is really comes across with the way montage is used. Mm-hmm. I really want to give a good friendships for them. Yes. I love their friendship, but also importantly, rest in peace, Bella's friendship and her closeness with Ricky, which is what kind of allows the whole narrative to take flight, I think is also important to note.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So I'm going to say at this point in his career, Sam Neill is a stunt cast, even though he is a New Zealander. Also, shout out, if you ever need wholesome, very delightful content, follow Sam Neill because he does live on a farm in real life. And so he has just tons of videos of him being like, let's go and talk to the duck today. Or like, let's check in with the cow. Fantastic.
I love this.
Okay, I'm going to say a dead body because unfortunately when Bella passes, that is what instigates our journey into the bush.
Absolutely.
And then in the film, we do have a sexual awakening because Ricky is clearly willing to go with Kahu when he sees her ride up in slow motion on the back of a horse.
Oh my God. There's like a Cadbury Flake ad on TV and it's like this person like just having this rapturous experience eating a Cadbury Flake bar. And I remember that ad from visiting my grandparents. Oh. And so it's so funny to me when he like basically has his sexual awakening to a Cadbury Flake ad. Does crack me up.
The other one I have isn't very obviously a road trip because the whole book in particular is just one long road trip through the bush.
And also borrowed time because while the book feels like they could go on forever like this, in the film, you know that they can't. Once the tanks come out, Joe, it's pretty clear they're going to get caught.
I had to agree with Heck. It could not continue.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, that is not a line.
No, I didn't expect us to get a line. It is a coming-of-age story, the book especially, but it's not a particularly tropey YA.
No, no.
No. That said, this was a really enjoyable read, and I think most people in North America have probably never heard of Barry Crump.
No.
He's worth seeking out, honestly. It's really fun, and I could be persuaded to read other of his books, I think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe, this is the end of New Zealand month.
It is, and indeed.
I think we could definitely call what's coming next a bit of a record scratch from where we've been.
Brennan's tend to torture you once again.
Oh, God. Yeah, Joe's making me read and watch The Kissing Booth 2, Going the Distance. God.
That addition to the title. just call it The Kissing Booth 2 and be done with it.
Anyway, so that's where we're going next, folks. Mm-hmm. If you want to write into us about New Zealand Month, feel free to send in some corrections. We'd be happy to hear them. Or anything else you've heard on the show, you can find us on social media at HKHSPod or on the hashtag HKHSPod. Joe, where do they find you?
I can be reached at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B.
And I'm at Brenna C. Gray. That's Gray with an A. And if you've got anything long form, you know we'd love to put you in our mailbag. So go ahead and email us at hkhspod@gmail.com.
I love it when you say it that way because it sounds adorable with your voice. But if I said it in a particular tone, it would sound like we were going to abduct people Krampus style and put them into a bag. We know you'd love to end up in our mailbag.
That's why you host a horror podcast and I do not.
True. Facts. Yeah. Facts.
So, folks, until next time, I will see you on the page.
And I will see you on the screen.
Yeah, so this book by Barry Cramp...